So today we're going to look at relationships and sexuality, and it's actually a lot of philosophy in order to understand the Jewish view on all of this. So, and you can ask any questions you want at any point, but let's first go through a little bit of the philosophy just so we can kind of understand where we're holding and what all of this is about. So I'm thankful that I've spoken to this group before. We've hit a lot of different concepts here and there. So let's just start with a little test. What is the purpose of creation? See, I don't know if we talked about that or not. If we did, do you remember? And if not, what is it? Why are we here? What's the whole point?
To believe in God.
To have a relationship with God.
Good, for a relationship with God. And once we have that relationship with God, what do we get?
I don't remember.
Wrap it up in one word. One word. Pleasure. We are created for pleasure and for no other purpose than pleasure. 100%. So we're totally pleasure driven. That's why we're here.
Pleasure, yeah. Pleasure.
Oh, good. So the question is, what pleasure and when do we get it? I mean, how many of us feel like we're living in total pleasure here? Not many of us, right? We have little bits and pieces of pleasure. There's bites of pleasure along the way, but pleasure, we're created for pleasure. That is the purpose of creation in one word. The purpose of creation is pleasure. The nature of God, who is good, the nature of good is to give good. That's what good wants to do. Good wants to give pleasure. So the question is, what pleasure? So we know that there's lots of different types of pleasure. Aisha Torah has a whole lecture, the five levels of pleasure, which I think is a construct, but the idea is to figure out what is the most pleasurable thing. But just for us, we can understand, right, kid in college studying for exam, friends come into the room and say, want to go get pizza and a beer? So now there's a conflict between two pleasures, right? There's the immediate pleasure of pizza and a beer and hanging out with friends. And then there's the more long-term pleasure of the A on the test, which leads to the even more long-term pleasure of the degree or the career that you want, the education that you want to have, right? So part of maturing is being able to discern pleasures and which pleasures are the pleasures that you actually want to go for, right? So part of the maturational process is being able to forego a short-term pleasure for a long-term goal, which is really the longer-term pleasure, right? So that's part of our training ourselves. That's how dieting works, right? Forgo the short-term pleasure for the long-term goal, right? It doesn't work for me, obviously, but there is a phrase that helps, and nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. It turns out things do taste as good as that. Which is why we eat them. But, but the concept is, what's the greater pleasure? So, and we have, as we know, voices within us that speak to and are driven towards pleasures in opposite directions. So the body has its own voice and the soul has its own voice. And many times those voices are in conflict. Right? So soul wants the spiritual pleasures, body wants the physical pleasures, and sometimes they lead the body and lead the person in opposite directions. So, but really our quest, if we can understand that we are created to receive pleasure. That's the whole reason for our creation. So if we understand that, then we have to figure out how do we get the most pleasure? Where? Here and the next world. In both places. The next world is the place of total and complete pleasure. This is the world of pleasure here and there because this is the world of earning and that's the world of receiving. This is the world of working towards. That's the world of dwelling in. There is no accomplishing in the next world. There's only accomplishing here. So the question is, how do we get the most pleasure? So what is the most pleasurable thing that there is? What's the greatest good? Have I ever asked you this riddle? It comes out of, I think I did once, right? This comes out of Christian paradigm, but it's still a good riddle. What's better than God? Worse than the devil? The poor have it. The rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die.
Nothing.
Right.
What?
Nothing. No. Nothing, right? Nothing's better than God, nothing's worse than the devil. That's the Christian part, because we don't believe in that. Nothing's better than God, nothing's worse than the devil. The poor have nothing, the rich need nothing, and if you eat nothing, you'll die, right? So if we want to say, what's the best good? If God wants to give good, and God wants to give the best good, so better than money, better than race cars, better than good food, better than loving relationships, better than world peace is God. Right? God's the best good that there is. So God wants to give God's self. If God wants to give good, God wants to give God. So then the question is, how does God give God's self? How do we give ourselves to another? Not our time, not our money, not our advice, but how do we give ourself to another? What's the mechanism that we can give ourselves to another?
Mitzvahs, good deeds.
We can do nice things for people.
Children.
Children. What about children?
Well, by having a child, you're giving part of yourself to...
Good, so you're talking physically, genetically, you give yourself. Right? How can you give your whole self? Through a relationship. The strongest relationship here being marriage. A good marriage is where you can give the most of your whole selfness to another. Other relationships, friendships particularly, you can give a very strong piece of yourself. That's more than time, more than advice, more than money, more than stuff, but selfness. You exchange in a friendship, right? You can give part of yourself, but in a strong marriage, you can almost give. We can't because we're human beings and we're limited, but you can almost give your whole self in a marriage to somebody else, right? With somebody else. That's how you give yourself to another. But how do you do that, really, is the question. But marriage, let's just think about the quality of marriage for a minute. So in Judaism, we learn about divorce before we learn about marriage. Because in order to have a strong marriage, there has to be divorce. How does that work, right? I see lots of question marks on your faces, right? So my husband worked in a liquor warehouse. His father was vice president of Seagram's when my husband was a teenager. So he got a job in the liquor warehouse for the summer when he was 17, schlepping boxes of liquor onto trucks, right, with all the Italian guys who were doing that. So he sat around listening to the Italian guys talking. So one of them said, he's engaged. And somebody else said, who are you engaged to? He said, oh, this really nice girl. I met her. She's so sweet. I love her. So the Italian guy says to him, he says, what are you getting married for love for? He says, you should marry one of your father's paisano's daughters. He said, you marry for love first, and you love a her, then she love a you, then you don't love a her, she don't love a you, and then you have to get a gun or a divorce or something. Right? So this really shows a whole cultural paradigm here. A gun or a divorce or something, right? Because in Catholic tradition, you marry for life. There is no divorce. So if you get married, you're trapped. In Judaism, you are not trapped. There is an exit door 100% of the time, which means every day you're married is because you choose it, because you can leave it. So if there is a door out, when you stay in, it's your choice. And that's the strength of marriage, is that it's based, Jewish marriage, is that it's based on mutual free will.
But doesn't in a divorce, doesn't the man have to agree to the divorce? Can't
the woman has to agree too.
Yeah, but if the woman wants it and the man won't give it to her, I mean,
there are halachic problems, especially today when our community has fallen apart. And that's only because our community has fallen apart. It's a different discussion. But just quickly, it is true that the way marriage is affected in Judaism is that the man promises the woman to take care of her. And under the chuppah, we read in the marriage contract, he promises her, she doesn't promise him anything. He promises her, I'll feed you, I'll house you, I'll clothe you, and I'll sexually satisfy you. Which is why we read it in Aramaic, because how embarrassing would that be to read that out loud in English when people get married. But that's what he promises her. She has those rights that she can demand of him. If he does not satisfy her sexually, or house her, or clothe her, or feed her according to his ability in all those categories, then she has the right to demand a divorce, and he has to divorce her. Let's say he chooses not to, because the way divorce is affected is he has to now take the contract back. He's the one who gave the contract. He now has to give a contract that rescinds the promise. So that's how it works. She can't just leave, right? It has to work that way. So occasionally, and especially now with a broken down community, men, at any time, a man might not want to. He might say, you know what, I hate you, and I'm gonna get you. I'm going to keep you trapped. That's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to give you a divorce. I can marry somebody else, but you can't. I will trap you. Right? So today, that's a problem. But before today, let's say 75 years ago and all the way before when we had a stronger Jewish community, the way it works is the community could compel him to do it. First, by sanctions, right? First, by saying, no aliyahs, no business, no talking to you. You are outside the community. People will cross the street. They won't say hello. They won't have a conversation. They won't sell you anything. They won't buy anything from you. You can't even come into shul and daven with them. You're not part of the community. And so that kind of pressure usually did the trick. The guy would be broken. Let's say that didn't work. He's a really nasty guy, and he could care less what the community thinks of him. No problem. In a strong Jewish community, we understand that in the deeper parts of us, we talked about body and soul sometimes pull us apart, right? Body may be saying, really get her. Soul is saying, I want to do the will of God. The will of God is let her go, right? Sometimes the body gets in the way of hearing the soul's voice. So we have a little method in the Jewish community of releasing that voice in the body of a husband who won't do it. Well, the way that we release the voice of the soul is by beating him. Till his body...
Beating him?
Yep. We hire thugs, we grab him, we beat him, until he says, I desire it! I want to give her a get! And we stop beating so he can hand over the contract and then let him go. And that's how it works. That's how it works. That only works in a strong community, right? It can't work in this country because there's laws that oppose that. But in a strong Jewish community where we take care of our own, that's how we take care of women. Today we have to hire lawyers and all that stuff to make it work. But in a strong Jewish community, we take care of it. We don't let women get trapped. Right, so today in Israel, the way it works, sometimes it works like that in a smaller community, in a Hasidic community or whatever, where it still works that way. Let's say somebody's not in that type of a community where it's not working that way, so they just put him in jail until he says, yes, I want it. Right, that's how we do it today. However, some people still won't do it, and they'd rather rot in jail than give their wives a divorce. So there are a few women who are still stuck. But really, the best way is to beat him until he says, I want to do it. You release his soul voice by making his body get it. And that's the traditional Jewish way of doing it.
So how about a woman who, I know a woman who didn't want a divorce.
Okay.
It's supposed to be mutual. And
it is.
Her husband got one anyway.
Right. So a woman's not allowed to trap a man either. And she can trap him by saying, I'm not taking it. I refuse. I'm going to trap you. Now, today you can trap him because today men cannot marry a second wife. Although halachically they can. According to Jewish law, they are permitted. But according to Jewish decree, they're not permitted. We now have a decree that a man can only marry one wife. So if she won't accept the divorce, he's still married and he's also trapped. So what do you do? Right? So you're not going to beat her. Because that's not how we do it. What we do in that case, it's called a heter mea rabbanim. You get a heter, you get a permission from 100 rabbis. And it has to be 100. So you go, I know a man who did this, right? His wife refused in order to trap him. So he had to go to 100 rabbis and explain the situation and get the signature of 100 different rabbis. After 100 rabbis said, we hear the situation, and so what you should do is write up the divorce contract, deposit it with the Beit Din, so that she can come and get it anytime she wants. You're out of the picture now. You're still married. But you have deposited it now, and it's up to her. Whenever she wants to get it, she can get it. Now you may marry somebody else. That's what we permit you to do. So now he's married to two. It's not an official divorce. He's now married to two women, but he is permitted to do that. And I think a man may possibly be able to do that also if his wife is mentally, if she becomes a vegetable and can't either mentally or physically at all relate to him at all. And so he can't divorce her. It's not possible because she has to receive the divorce. So if something happens to her so that she can't be divorced, but let's say she's, you know, what's her name, Terry Schiavo, right, for 20 years a vegetable in a hospital, but he wants to go on with his life, he can't divorce her. But I think he could do this pathway also and be married to two, I'm pretty sure.
What about the other way around? It's the man who is incapacitated.
I don't know how it works to release her from the marriage, if it's possible to do that. I'm not sure how to do that.
Is it part of a Jewish ceremony where they say till death do us part, or is that...
No, that is not Jewish at all. Nope, no death to us part. It's till we both decide we don't want it anymore.
Okay.
So is it acceptable in this country also if a man can be married to a second wife?
So,
because I heard in Israel there are some rabbis that can marry a man to have a second wife.
You only so today in the Jewish world, Sephardic and Ashkenazic, a man only marries a second wife in a case like this. However, in Israel, what you may be thinking about is there is a grandfather clause, because this gezeira, this decree to only marry one, was in the Ashkenazic world and not in the Sephardic world. So those Sephardic Jews that made aliyah with two wives were not required to divorce one of them to move to Israel. So there's a grandfather clause for those Jews who married two. They came from Arab lands where that was a more of a common practice. So anybody who came with more than one wife could keep their extra wives. But from now on, no marrying more than one, even from the Sephardic lands. Right. Okay, that's the whole parenthetical thing. That's not part of this. Okay. So we know now, right, the mechanism that God can give God's self to another is through relationship. So the question is then, if God wants to do that, how does he have a relationship with us, really? We're the ones. So God wants to give God's self. That's the whole purpose of God wants to give good, and he created us only to receive it. That's the whole reason he created us. So we have to look at creation for just a minute. So you can either take a chumash and read along, or I'll read to you. Or you can just write where it is in Genesis 1, 26 to 27. We have two parallel creation stories of humankind. So Genesis 1, 26 says, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created mankind in this own image, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So you know that when we look at biblical text, we always look very carefully at the words. Anytime there's a grammatical inconsistency or a different type of a spelling, that is a flag in the ground that says, buried treasure here, dig further. Okay, so right here we have, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Him, them, did he create a him or a them? What did he create? That's a flag. Dig here, buried treasure. What is going on? That's where Rashi asks his questions, underneath all those flags. So, and we also have the first flag in these few sentences is, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. What do we as Jews know about God that makes that sound very weird? God is one, right? So what's the us? What is the plural language? Big flag. And as a matter of fact, the Midrashic authors say, tell the story of Moses when he's on the mountain taking dictation. God says the sentence, and Moses is about to write, and he says, wait a second, God, I can't write that. That's plural. You're one. What is could we rephrase that so that it will be heard correctly? And God said, those who will err, and those who will know. Write it like I said it. Let us, plural. So now the commentators have to discuss it, right? What is going on here? And there's lots of different discussions on it. So I'll give you two of the answers here. One of them is that God was setting an example for us, that he consulted the angels. Let us is the angels. Could the angels really make man? No, they couldn't. They're underlings, really. So God is setting an example for us. Whenever we set out to do something important, consult somebody else, even if they're beneath you. Now, you shouldn't make important decisions or start important products and projects on your own. So he is setting an example. That's one of the commentaries. Another one, and there's many more, but the one that I like, and for the purposes of this class, we're going to go with, which doesn't mean that others aren't correct. This is just one thread of commentaries, because there's so many. Avraham Tversky shares this commentary. Let us make man is addressing us. God is saying to us, let us make man. I, God, will start you off. I'll make you into a blob of flesh and have you be born a blob of flesh with shape, right? But you now finish the job. Make yourself into a mensch. And I'm not making, you're not born a mensch. You're not born kind or giving or with a direction or a purpose, right? You have to do that to yourself. Many people don't. Many people choose to live like an animal, right? Allowing their physical drives to take them wherever they want to go. We all have instincts, right? And that's exactly what the snake was saying to Eve. You know, the snake came over to Eve and was talking to her. We don't even think about this, a walking, talking snake, right? We're so used to Disney that a walking, talking snake doesn't even raise our antennas at all. But in the whole Torah, there's only two talking animals, the snake and Bilam's donkey, right? And it's meant to be strange. You're meant to wonder, a walking, talking snake? What is that? Right? So the snake is saying to Eve, didn't God say, don't eat from this tree? And she says, yes. He says, well, God said it because he doesn't want you to be like him. Right? He says, what do you want? Basically, I'm paraphrasing the conversation. She says, well, it looks yummy to me. So he says, that's also God talking. He's trying to confuse her. He's saying, as an animal, I can tell you, instincts are God's voice inside of you. Why don't you listen to that? If you want it, God's saying, eat it. It's good for you. Because that's how animals are. They know not to eat something that's not good for them, except chocolate, right, for dogs. But but basically, animals don't eat what's bad for them, and they do eat what's good for them. That's their instinct. Their instinct drives them to eat what's right, right? But human beings have a different, we have instinct. We go for things. There's certain things that our body drives us towards. But we have the ability to override that and listen to a moral voice, right? So a married person who's attracted to somebody other than their spouse can say, I choose not to go where this attraction takes me because I believe that's wrong. And so they override their instinct, right? Only human beings can do that. Other animals go where they want to go, wherever their body takes them. That's where they head. So that let us make man is God saying, I'll start you off and you finish the process. You make yourself into a mensch. I'll make you into a blob of flesh with potential. You make yourself into something. Right? So there's a phrase that I like a lot. What we are is God's gift to us. What we make of ourselves is our gift to God. So what we are is God's gift to us. What we make of ourselves is our gift to God. As we transform ourselves, we should exit differently than we came in. So, and I think we've talked about in this class what a mitzvah is, you know, that we have to ask the question. So we know that now the purpose of creation is pleasure, but we have to ask, what's the purpose of this world? Why are we here? If we're a soul before we're born, and we're a soul after we die, then what's the point of wearing a body for 60, 80, 90, 120 years, right? What is the point of this? So I'll leave that question for just a minute. but we do have to ask that question, right? So we know we're created for pleasure. So we see here, let's look back at the creation here. So God says, let's create a human being. So he created this human being in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Let's first just look at the fact that God created a human being. The whole purpose of this entire world is to create a creature who can receive God's goodness. We said that the mechanism for receiving God's goodness is relationship, so that God had to create a creature that could be an